I mentioned this last week, but I bet you thought I was only joking. Here's how I feel about Advent, the four Sundays leading up to Christmas. Unapologetically singing Christmas carols during Advent since 1975. That's us. And here's what preachers all over the world are preaching this morning based on the recommended lectionary readings. There will be signs in the sun, the moon, and the stars, and on the earth distress among nations, confused by the roaring of the sea and the waves. People will faint from fear and foreboding of what is coming upon the world, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Be on guard, so that your hearts are not weighed down with dissipation and drunkenness and the worries of this life, and that day does not catch you unexpectedly like a trap. I just don't think we need that this morning. I'm one of those, we need a little Christmas right this very minute, people. And I have a story to tell you that I think will help you understand my willingness to go against the grain, if you will, and why I think it's important that we just go ahead and launch right into these stories. I had forgotten the story I'm about to tell you until my younger daughter told it with great glee and sweeping hand gestures at Thanksgiving. Many years ago, the shower head in our downstairs bathroom was leaking. I consulted the internet, found the parts I needed. Then I went to the hardware store and told the nice man who was trying to help me with my project something like, "I'm sure all I need is the little round piece that has the screw that stops the thing that the handle turns." Lo and behold, I got home with the right part, searched the area between our yard and the neighbors, turned off the water, and successfully repaired the shower head. Thank you. Just hold that thought. Fast forward 10 months, when the shower head in the upstairs bathroom started leaking, I had no doubt I could fix it. I still remembered the steps from before. I gathered up all my tools before I started, made sure to do the most important thing, turn off the water at the meter. I had to work awfully hard. The grass had grown up covering the meters, and there was a lot of gunk down there, but finally that little dial on the water meter stopped turning, and I knew I had turned off the water. So I went upstairs, took off the outer fixture, grabbed my great big wrench, which I had bought especially for the occasion, so that I wouldn't have to borrow one from my neighbor, and began unscrewing the brass bonnet. One turn, two, and on three, that thing shot out of there. All I could think was how it looked in the Beverly Hillbillies when Uncle Jed strikes oil and it comes gushing out, except thank God this was clean water. For a good 30 seconds or so, I tried mightily to wrestle that cartridge back into the spout and stop the flow, but I could see that the water was already rising in the bathtub, and in no time at all, that water would be over the top. So I called. Did I mention this was Thanksgiving morning? I thought I'd take care of a few things before all the cooking commenced. I called all the family upstairs with buckets to bail. I thought we could empty some of it in the sink and some of it in the toilet and try to keep the tub from overflowing. And once they got started with the bailing, I ran back outside with my big wrench to see if I could get the right water turned off, which I thought I had done, but it turns out I had turned off my neighbor's water instead. I started banging around on the ground with the wrench, and sure enough, I finally found the other water meter. The grass had completely covered it over in the months since I had last tried to fix a faucet, and I had forgotten which meter out there went to which house. There are more pieces to this story, like the part where my daughter called the water department and my neighbor, not the one whose water I had turned off, And that neighbor came over to help. And the part where water started running out of the kitchen light fixtures, because the kitchen was under the upstairs bathroom. But none of that is the point. The point is that after less than a year, I'd already lost the ability to fix the water faucet. I had forgotten important details. I'd lost major parts. Having that experience only once a year, the fixing, not the flooding, having that experience only once a year is not enough. The learning didn't last. So I believe it's a good thing that we share these biblical stories, especially the nativity stories, every chance we get. And it's even better when we're sharing these old stories that we know so much of by heart when we find something new or precious in them. I told you that Amy Jo Levine is a professor of New Testament and Jewish Studies at Hartford International University. She works in biblical studies, and I love this about her. She is a self-described critic of anti-Semitic, sexist, and homophobic theologies. She is a Jew who loves Christmas and confesses to often walking the hallways of the seminary humming Christmas carols. And she's written a book called The Light of the World. And she says, quote, "The more I read the nativity stories in Matthew and Luke, the more drawn in I am. Each sentence, each word shimmers with significance, with allusions to Jewish texts and Roman history, with connection to other words and stories in the Gospels. And these Gospels," she says, "seek to tell us, we readers, about the connection of the good news of Jesus, both to the story of Israel and to the Gentile world, and about the clash of imperial and heavenly values, and about a world for which many of us hope. A world for which many of us hope." So this year we're going to dig into the Gospels of Matthew and Luke, there where we find the Christmas stories, and we're going to try to find some new things. And I'm starting this morning by preaching on the first 17 verses of Matthew, which I have never preached on before. And I bet these are some of your favorite verses to skip so that you can get to the, "Now this is how the birth of Jesus Christ came about, when his mother Mary was betrothed to Joseph, but before they lived together." That's verse 18. That's the one we want to get to. So bear with me. I'm not going to read you all of these 17 verses because I'm afraid you would fall asleep on me, but I'm going to read most of them, beginning with the first verse of the first chapter of Matthew's Gospel. "An account of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, and Judah the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar, and Perez the father of Hezron, and Hezron the father of Aram, and Aram the father of Aminadab, the father of Nahshon, and Nahshon the father of Salmon, and Salmon the father of Boaz by Rahab, and Boaz the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of King David. And David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah, and Solomon the father of Rehoboam, and Rehoboam the father of Abijah, and Abijah the father of Asaph, and Asaph the father of Jehoshaphat, and Jehoshaphat the father of Joram, and Joram the father of Uzziah, and Uzziah the father of Jotham, and Jotham the father of Ahaz. And Eliud, the father of Eleazar, and Eleazar, the father of Mathan, and Mathan, the father of Jacob, and Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, who bore Jesus, who is called the Messiah. So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations, and from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations, and from the deportation to Babylon to the Messiah, 14 generations. I don't have time this morning to share with you all that Amy Jill Levine uncovers for us in this passage, but there are a few important pieces I want to draw your attention to. And first, the genealogy begins with an account of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. In this way, Jesus is connected immediately to Father Abraham, the patriarch of Israel, and King David, whose descendants God has promised will rule forever. But we're going to move on from that to something else Levine thinks is very important. And that is this. Matthew's genealogy, did you see the yellow parts I highlighted? Mentions four women before introducing Mary as Joseph's betrothed. But the women that Matthew mentions are not the expected ones, the ones we've heard about since Sunday school, the Sarahs, Rebeccas, Leahs, and Rachels. The first woman mentioned in the New Testament, right here in Matthew's opening verses, is Tamar. Tamar, who was married to a son of Judah. Tamar's husband died, and the Levirate law said he died without leaving her a child. And the Levirate law said that by rights, Tamar could marry the younger brother and bear a child through him so that the line continues. And she did marry the other brother. And he was not faithful, and God struck him dead. And she went back to Judah and said, "You have more sons, and I desire a child." And Judah put her off. So Tamar took things into her own hands, and knowing that Judah was a man of lusty appetites, she disguised herself one day when she knew he was passing by, passed herself off as a prostitute, invited him in, later gave birth to a child by him. And when he found out that he had been duped, he accused her of adultery. And she said, "You can accuse me of adultery, but here are the things you left with me in payment for your services." So it was not adultery on my part. That's Tamar. She took action when Judah refused to marry her to his youngest son. The second woman mentioned is Rahab. Some of you will remember Rahab, the prostitute from Jericho. When Joshua was trying to get the lay of the land, he sent spies into Jericho. And they, I guess, as part of their mission, ended up at a brothel. And the king's men came looking for them. And they didn't know what to do. Rahab hid them to protect them from the king's men. And then later she came to them and she said, "I believe that this God you say you represent is a true God. And so I helped you. And now I'm going to help you climb down this window, climb down this wall, and get back to your people. And I know that you're coming back to attack the city. And I know that you'll probably kill everybody there, but you should not kill me and my family because of what I have done for you." And there's a whole lot more to that story, but again, many of you will remember that when the armies came in to sack the city, Rahab displayed a red cord from her window, and everyone knew that those people gathered there should be safe. Again, a brave, courageous, smart woman. The third woman mentioned is Ruth, the Moabite widow who told her mother-in-law, Naomi, I'm not going to stay here with my people. I'm going with you. And together, the two go and end up in the home of the Bethlehemite Boaz. And you might remember that they desperately need a child. They're single women. They need a husband who will protect them and a child. And so she appeals to Boaz's sense of honor and says, you know, you kind of owe this to the family. And through some various seductions and others, she ended up having a child. Ruth became Boaz's wife. And instead of her story ending in childlessness, she became the great-grandmother of King David. And finally, she of Uriah, that's how it says it in the genealogy, she of Uriah, which means the wife of Uriah. We talked about that story recently in the context of cancel culture. Remember that David could have been canceled. He stole another man's wife. When he found out she was pregnant, King David had her husband killed, basically, at the front lines. But Bathsheba had a son named Solomon, who shows up in that genealogy as a forebear of Jesus. So Levine tells us that Matthew appears to be making at least 4 points here. And first, he says, women contributed to salvation history as well as the men, so pay attention to the women. Second, these women represented very different family structures. We often talk about what is the biblical family, and we come to different conclusions about that. But you think about these women. Tamar was a levirate widow, which means she married a succession of sons and then ultimately conceived with their father. And Rahab appears to be a single woman who owned the brothel where she ran her business. And Ruth was a widow who would have had no real station, but she doesn't give up or go back to her family. She goes with Naomi and marries Boaz. And Bathsheba was a victim in all of this, but she was strong and she was faithful and she gave birth to Solomon. The third thing that Levine points out is that Rahab was a Canaanite, not an Israelite. Ruth is a Moabite, not an Israelite. And Uriah, so probably Uriah's wife Bathsheba, was a Hittite, not an Israelite. Matthew seems to be setting the stage, as we'll see throughout his gospel, that the birth of Jesus is good news, not just for Jews, but also for Gentiles. And we will see over and over in Matthew's gospel, Jesus responding to these Gentiles, finding them faithful. And fourth, all the women in this genealogy are involved in very unconventional relationships that lead to their bearing sons, which just might be preparing us for that most unconventional of all, when Mary, the young maid, before she lives with her husband Joseph, gives birth to a son, Jesus. And that's where I want to start wrapping up today with these women. They weren't just ordinary, faithful, brave women. They were extraordinary women, and they weren't the usual suspects that we hear about when we read our Bibles and we listen to our preachers. They weren't the Sarahs and the Rachels and the Leahs. And each of these women, they risked their lives. They risked their livelihoods. They certainly risked their reputations. Ah, their tenacity. Their savvy. Their, I will protect what is mine and receive what is mine. They are as bad as it gets. And as we read these verses, we should draw hope from them. Today, in addition to the light of the world, we're talking about the light of hope. And these stories, we should draw hope from these stories. Not the hope that is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. Not the hope that blesses those who wait upon the Lord. But the hope that another Matthew, not the gospel writer, another Matthew has recently shared with us. This Matthew says, people speak of hope as if it is this delicate, ephemeral thing made of whispers and spiders' webs. It is not. Hope has dirt on her face, blood on her knuckles, the grit of the cobblestones in her hair, and just spit out a tooth as she rises for another go. Advent hope. As we see in this genealogy in Matthew, Advent hope, the promise that one is coming whose courage and faithfulness will save not only a family tree, but the whole world. Jesus, the light of the world. Amen.